The Consolation of Philosophy by Anicus Manlius Boethius. Translated into English prose and verse by H.R. James. Oxford, England, 1897. Preface. The book called The Consolation of Philosophy was throughout the Middle Ages, and down to the beginnings of the modern epoch in the 16th century, the scholar's familiar companion. Few books have exercised a wider influence in their time. It has been translated into every European tongue, and into English nearly a dozen times, from King Alfred's paraphrase to the translations of Lord Preston, Causton, Ridpath, and Duncan, in the 18th century. The belief that what once pleased so widely must still have some charm is my excuse for attempting the present translation. The great work of Boethius, with its alternate prose and verse, skillfully fitted together like dialogue and chorus in a Greek play, is unique in literature, and has a pathetic interest from the time and circumstances of its composition. It ought not to be forgotten. Biographical sketch. Anicus Manlius Boethius lived around 500 AD. He was growing to manhood, when Theodoric, the famous Ostrogoth, crossed the Alps and made himself despot of Italy. Boethius belonged to an ancient family, which boasted a connection with the legendary glories of the Republic, and was still among the foremost in wealth and dignity in the days of Rome's abasement. His parents dying early, he was brought up by Symmachus, whom the age agreed to regard as of almost saintly character, and afterwards became his son-in-law by marriage. Boethius' varied gifts, aided by an excellent education, won for him the reputation of the most accomplished man of his time. He was orator, poet, musician, and philosopher. It is his peculiar distinction to have handed on to the Middle Ages the tradition of Greek philosophy by his Latin translations of the works of Aristotle. Called early to a public career, the highest honors of the state came to him unsought. He was sole consul in 510 AD, and was ultimately raised by Theodoric the Barbarian to the dignity of Magister Officiorum, or head of the whole civil administration. Later in life he was a solitary prisoner at Pavia, stripped of honors, wealth, and friends, with death hanging over him, and a terror worse than death, in the fear lest those dearest to him should be involved in the worst results of his downfall. It is in this situation that the opening of the Consolation of Philosophy brings Boethius before us. He represents himself as seated in his prison distraught with grief, indignant at the injustice of his misfortunes, and seeking relief for his melancholy in writing verses descriptive of his condition. Suddenly there appears to him the divine figure of philosophy, in the guise of a woman of superhuman dignity and beauty, who by a succession of discourses convinces him of the vanity of regret for the lost gifts of fortune, raises his mind once more to the contemplation of the true good, and makes clear to him the mystery of the world's moral government. Book 1. Song 1. Boethius' Complaint. Who wrought my studious numbers smoothly once in happier days, now perforce in tears and sadness learn a mournful strain to raise. Lo, the muses, grief disheveled, guide my pen and voice my woe, down their cheeks unfeigned the tear drops to my sad complainings flow. These alone in danger's hour faithful found, have dared attend on the footsteps of the exile to his lonely journey's end. These that were the pride and pleasure of my youth and high estate still remain the only solace of the old man's mournful fate. Old. Ah yes, swift, ere I knew it, by these sorrows on me pressed age hath come, lo, grief hath bid me wear the garb that fits her best. O'er my head untimely sprinkled these white hairs my woes proclaim, and the skin hangs loose and shriveled on this sorrow-shrunken frame. Blessed is death that intervenes not in the sweet, sweet years of peace, but unto the broken-hearted, when they call him, brings release. Yet death passes by the wretched, shuts his ear and slumbers deep, will not heed the cry of anguish, will not close the eyes that weep. For, while yet inconstant fortune poured her gifts and all was bright, death's dark hour had all but whelmed me in the gloom of endless night. Now, because misfortune's shadow hath o'erclouded that false face, cruel life still halts and lingers, though I loathe his weary race. Friends, why did ye once so lightly vaunt me happy among men? Surely he who so hath fallen was not firmly founded then. 1. While I was thus mutely pondering within myself, and recording my sorrowful complainings with my pen, it seemed to me that there appeared above my head a woman of a countenance exceeding venerable. Her eyes were bright as fire, and of a more than human keenness, her complexion was lively, her vigor showed no trace of enfeeblement, and yet her years were right full, and she plainly seemed not of our age and time. Her stature was difficult to judge. At one moment it exceeded not the common height, at another her forehead seemed to strike the sky, and whenever she raised her head higher, she began to pierce within the very heavens, and to baffle the eyes of them that looked upon her. Her garments were of an imperishable fabric, wrought with the finest threads and of the most delicate workmanship, and these, as her own lips afterwards assured me, she had herself woven with her own hands. The beauty of this vesture had been somewhat tarnished by age and neglect, and wore that dingy look which marble contracts from exposure. On the lowermost edge was inwoven the Greek letter pi, on the topmost the letter theta, and between the two were to be seen steps, like a staircase, from the lower to the upper letter. This robe, moreover, had been torn by the hands of violent persons, who had each snatched away what he could clutch. Her right hand held a notebook, in her left she bore a staff. And when she saw the muses of poesy standing by my bedside, dictating the words of my lamentations, she was moved a while to wrath, and her eyes flashed sternly. "Who," said she, "has allowed yon play-acting wantons to approach this sick man? These who, so far from giving medicine to heal his malady, even feed it with sweet poison. These it is who kill the rich crop of reason with the barren thorns of passion, who accustom men's minds to disease, instead of setting them free. Now, were it some common man whom your allurements were seducing, as is usually your way, I should be less indignant. On such a one I should not have spent my pains for naught. But this is one nurtured in the Eleatic and academic philosophies. Nay, get ye gone, ye sirens, whose sweetness lasteth not, leave him for my muses to tend and heal." At these words of upbraiding, the whole band, in deepened sadness, with downcast eyes, and blushes that confessed their shame, dolefully left the chamber. But I, because my sight was dimmed with much weeping, and I could not tell who was this woman of authority so commanding, I was dumbfoundered, and, with my gaze fastened on the earth, continued silently to await what she might do next. Then she drew near me and sat on the edge of my couch, and, looking into my face all heavy with grief and fixed in sadness on the ground, she bewailed in these words the disorder of my mind. Song 2. His despondency. Alas! In what abyss his mind is plunged, how wildly tossed! Still towards the outer night she sinks, her true light lost, as oft as, lashed tumultuously by earth-borne blasts, care's waves rise high. Yet once he ranged the open heavens, the sun's bright pathway tracked, watched how the cold moon waxed and waned, nor rested, till there lacked to his wide ken no star that steers amid the maze of circling spheres. The causes why the blusterous winds vex ocean's tranquil face, whose hand doth turn the stable globe, or why his even race from out the ruddy east the sun unto the western waves doth run. What is it tempers cunningly the placid hours of spring, so that it blossoms with the rose for earth's and garlanding, who loads the year's maturer prime with clustered grapes in autumn time? All this he knew, thus ever strove deep nature's lore to guess. Now, reft of reason's light, he lies, and bonds his neck oppress, while by the heavy load constrained, his eyes to this dull earth are chained. 2. But the time, said she, calls rather for healing than for lamentation. Then, with her eyes bent full upon me, "Art thou that man," she cries, "who, erstwhile fed with the milk and reared upon the nourishment which is mine to give, had grown up to the full vigor of a manly spirit? And yet I had bestowed such armor on thee as would have proved an invincible defense, hadst thou not first cast it away. Dost thou know me? Why art thou silent? Is it shame or amazement that hath struck thee dumb? Would it were shame, but, as I see, a stupor hath seized upon thee." Then, when she saw me not only answering nothing, But mute and utterly incapable of speech, she gently touched my breast with her hand, and said, "There is no danger, these are the symptoms of lethargy, the usual sickness of deluded minds. For a while he has forgotten himself, he will easily recover his memory, if only he first recognizes me. And that he may do so, let me now wipe his eyes that are clouded with a mist of mortal things." Thereat, with a fold of her robe, she dried my eyes all swimming with tears. Song 3. The mists dispelled. Then the gloom of night was scattered, sight returned unto mine eyes. So, when haply rainy chorus rolls the storm clouds through the skies, hidden is the sun, all heaven is obscured in starless night. But if, in wild onset sweeping, Boreas frees day's prisoned light, all suddenly the radiant god outstreams, and strikes our dazzled eyesight with his beams. 3. Even so the clouds of my melancholy were broken up. I saw the clear sky, and regained the power to recognize the face of my physician. Accordingly, when I had lifted my eyes and fixed my gaze upon her, I beheld my nurse, Philosophy, whose halls I had frequented from my youth up. "Ah, why," I cried, "mistress of all excellence, hast thou come down from on high, and entered the solitude of this my exile? Is it that thou, too, even as I, mayst be persecuted with false accusations? Could I desert thee, child," said she, "and not lighten the burden which thou hast taken upon thee through the hatred of my name, by sharing this trouble? Even forgetting that it were not lawful for Philosophy to leave companionless the way of the innocent, should I, thinkest thou, fear to incur reproach, or shrink from it, as though some strange new thing had befallen? Thinkest thou that now, for the first time in an evil age, wisdom hath been assailed by peril? Did I not often in days of old, before my servant Plato lived, wage stern warfare with the rashness of folly? In his lifetime, too, Socrates, his master, won with my aid the victory of an unjust death. And when, one after the other, the Epicurean herd, the Stoic, and the rest, each of them as far as in them lay, went about to seize the heritage he left, and were dragging me off protesting and resisting, as their booty, they tore in pieces the garment which I had woven with my own hands, and, clutching the torn pieces, went off, believing that the whole of me had passed into their possession. And some of them, because some traces of my vesture were seen upon them, were destroyed through the mistake of the lewd multitude, who falsely deemed them to be my disciples. It may be thou knowest not of the banishment of Anaxagoras, of the poison draught of Socrates, nor of Zeno's torturing, because these things happened in a distant country, yet mightest thou have learned the fate of Arius, of Seneca, of Sarinus, whose stories are neither old nor unknown to fame. These men were brought to destruction for no other reason than that, settled as they were in my principles, their lives were a manifest contrast to the ways of the wicked. So there is nothing thou shouldst wonder at, if on the seas of this life we are tossed by storm blasts, seeing that we have made it our chiefest aim to refuse compliance with evildoers. And though, maybe, the host of the wicked is many in number, yet is it contemptible, since it is under no leadership, but is hurried hither and thither at the blind driving of mad error. And if at times and seasons they set in array against us, and fall on in overwhelming strength, our leader draws off her forces into the citadel while they are busy plundering the useless baggage. But we from our vantage ground, safe from all this wild work, laugh to see them making prize of the most valueless of things, protected by a bulwark which aggressive folly may not aspire to reach. Song 4. Nothing can subdue virtue. Whoso calm, serene, sedate, sets his foot on haughty fate, firm and steadfast, come what will, keeps his mien unconquered still, him the rage of furious seas, tossing high wild menaces, nor the flames from smoky forges that Vesuvius disgorges, nor the bolt that from the sky smites the tower, can terrify. Why, then, shouldst thou feel affright at the tyrant's weakling might? Dread him not, nor fear no harm, and thou shalt his rage disarm, but who to hope or fear gives way lost his bosom's rightful sway he hath cast away his shield, like a coward fled the field, He hath forged all unaware fetters his own neck must bear. 4. Dost thou understand, she asks. Do my words sink into thy mind? Or art thou dull as the ass to the sound of the lyre? Why dost thou weep? Why do tears stream from thy eyes? Speak out, hide it not in thy heart. If thou lookest for the physician's help, thou must needs disclose thy wound. Then I, gathering together what strength I could, began, Is there still need of telling? Is not the cruelty of fortune against me plain enough? Doth not the very aspect of this place move thee? Is this the library, the room which thou hadst chosen as thy constant resort in my home, the place where we so often sat together and held discourse of all things in heaven and earth? Was my garb and mien like this when I explored with thee nature's hid secrets, and thou didst trace for me with thy wand the courses of the stars, molding the while my character and the whole conduct of my life after the pattern of the celestial order? Is this the recompense of my obedience? Yet thou hast enjoined by Plato's mouth the maxim, that states would be happy, either if philosophers ruled them, or if it should so befall that their rulers would turn philosophers. By his mouth likewise thou didst point out this imperative reason why philosophers should enter public life, to wit, lest, if the reins of government be left to unprincipled and profligate citizens, trouble and destruction should come upon the good. Following these precepts, I have tried to apply in the business of public administration the principles which I learned from thee in leisured seclusion. Thou art my witness and that divinity who hath implanted thee in the hearts of the wise, that I brought to my duties no aim but zeal for the public good. For this cause I have become involved in bitter and irreconcilable feuds, and, as happens inevitably, if a man holds fast to the independence of conscience, I have had to think nothing of giving offense to the powerful in the cause of justice. How often have I encountered and balked Conagastus in his assaults on the fortunes of the weak? How often have I thwarted Trigilla, steward of the king's household, even when his villainous schemes were as good as accomplished? How often have I risked my position and influence to protect poor wretches from the false charges innumerable with which they were forever being harassed by the greed and license of the barbarians? No one has ever drawn me aside from justice to oppression. When ruin was overtaking the fortunes of the provincials through the combined pressure of private rapine and public taxation, I grieved no less than the sufferers. When at a season of grievous scarcity a forced sale, disastrous as it was unjustifiable, was proclaimed, and threatened to overwhelm Campania with starvation, I embarked on a struggle with the Praetorian prefect in the public interest, I fought the case at the king's judgment seat, and succeeded in preventing the enforcement of the sale. I rescued the consular Paulinus from the gaping jaws of the court bloodhounds, who in their covetous hopes had already made short work of his wealth. To save Albinus, who was of the same exalted rank, from the penalties of a prejudged charge, I exposed myself to the hatred of Cyprian, the informer. Thinkest thou I had laid up for myself store of enmities enough? Well, with the rest of my countrymen, at any rate, my safety should have been assured, since my love of justice had left me no hope of security at court. Yet who was it brought the charges by which I have been struck down? Why, one of my accusers is Basil, who, after being dismissed from the king's household, was driven by his debts to lodge an information against my name. There is Apilio, there is Gaudentius, men who for many and various offences the king's sentence had condemned to banishment, and when they declined to obey, and sought to save themselves by taking sanctuary, the king, as soon as he heard of it, decreed that, if they did not depart from the city of Ravenna within a prescribed time, they should be branded on the forehead and expelled. What would exceed the rigor of this severity? And yet on that same day these very men lodged an information against me, and the information was admitted. Just heaven! Had I deserved this by my way of life? Did it make them fit accusers that my condemnation was a foregone conclusion? Has fortune no shame if not at the accusation of the innocent, at least for the vileness of the accusers? Perhaps thou wonderest what is the sum of the charges laid against me? I wished, they say, to save the Senate. But how? I am accused of hindering an informer from producing evidence to prove the Senate guilty of treason. Tell me, then, what is thy counsel, O my mistress? Shall I deny the charge, lest I bring shame on thee? But I did wish it, and I shall never cease to wish it. Shall I admit it? Then the work of thwarting the informer will come to an end. Shall I call the wish for the preservation of that illustrious house a crime? Of a truth the Senate, by its decrees concerning me, has made it such. But blind folly, though it deceive itself with false names, cannot alter the true merits of things, and, mindful of the precept of Socrates, I do not think it right either to keep the truth concealed or allow falsehood to pass. But this, however it may be, I leave to thy judgment and to the verdict of the discerning. Moreover, lest the course of events and the true facts should be hidden from posterity, I have myself committed to writing an account of the transaction. What need to speak of the forged letters by which an attempt is made to prove that I hoped for the freedom of Rome? Their falsity would have been manifest, if I had been allowed to use the confession of the informers themselves, evidence which has in all matters the most convincing force. Why, what hope of freedom is left to us? Would there were any? I should have answered with the epigram of Canius when Caligula declared him to have been cognizant of a conspiracy against him. If I had known, said he, thou shouldst never have known. Grief hath not so blunted my perceptions in this matter that I should complain because impious wretches contrive their villainies against the virtuous, but at their achievement of their hopes I do exceedingly marvel. For evil purposes are, perchance, due to the imperfection of human nature, that it should be possible for scoundrels to carry out their worst schemes against the innocent, while God beholdeth, is verily monstrous. For this cause, not without reason, one of thy disciples asked, if God exists, whence comes evil? Yet whence comes good, if he exists not? However, it might well be that wretches who seek the blood of all honest men and of the whole Senate should wish to destroy me also, whom they saw to be a bulwark of the Senate and all honest men. But did I deserve such a fate from the fathers also? Thou rememberest, methinks since thou didst ever stand by my side to direct what I should do or say thou rememberest, I say, how at Verona, when the king, eager for the general destruction, was bent on implicating the whole senatorial order in the charge of treason brought against Albinus, with what indifference to my own peril I maintained the innocence of its members, one and all. Thou knowest that what I say is the truth, and that I have never boasted of my good deeds in a spirit of self-praise. For whenever a man by proclaiming his good deeds receives the recompense of fame, he diminishes in a measure the secret reward of a good conscience. What issues have overtaken my innocency thou seest? Instead of reaping the rewards of true virtue, I undergo the penalties of a guilt falsely laid to my charge. Nay, more than this, never did an open confession of guilt cause such unanimous severity among the assessors, but that some consideration, either of the mere frailty of human nature, or of fortune's universal instability, availed to soften the verdict of some few. Had I been accused of a design to fire the temples, to slaughter the priests with impious sword, of plotting the massacre of all honest men, I should yet have been produced in court, and only punished on due confession or conviction. Now for my too great zeal towards the Senate I have been condemned to outlawry and death, unheard and undefended, at a distance of near 500 miles away. Oh, my judges, well do ye deserve that no one should hereafter be convicted of a fault like mine. Yet even my very accusers saw how honorable was the charge they brought against me, and, in order to overlay it with some shadow of guilt, they falsely asserted that in the pursuit of my ambition I had stained my conscience with sacrilegious acts. And yet thy spirit, indwelling in me, had driven from the chamber of my soul all lust of earthly success, and with thine eye ever upon me, there could be no place left for sacrilege. For thou didst daily repeat in my ear and instill into my mind the Pythagorean maxim, follow after God. It was not likely, then, that I should covet the assistance of the vilest spirits, when thou wert molding me to such an excellence as should conform me to the likeness of God. Again, the innocency of the inner sanctuary of my home, the company of friends of the highest probity, a father-in-law revered at once for his pure character and his active beneficence, shield me from the very suspicion of sacrilege. Yet atrocious as it is, they even draw credence for this charge from thee, I am like to be thought implicated in wickedness on this very account, that I am imbued with thy teachings and established in thy ways. So it is not enough that my devotion to thee should profit me nothing, but thou also must be assailed by reason of the odium which I have incurred. Verily this is the very crown of my misfortunes, that men's opinions for the most part look not to real merit, but to the event, and only recognize foresight where fortune has crowned the issue with her approval. Whereby it comes to pass that reputation is the first of all things to abandon the unfortunate. I remember with chagrin how perverse is popular report, how various and discordant men's judgments. This only will I say, that the most crushing of misfortune's burdens is, that as soon as a charge is fastened upon the unhappy, they are believed to have deserved their sufferings. I, for my part, who have been banished from all life's blessings, stripped of my honors, stained in repute, am punished for well-doing. And now methinks I see the villainous dens of the wicked surging with joy and gladness, all the most recklessly unscrupulous threatening a new crop of lying informations, the good prostrate with terror at my danger, every ruffian incited by impunity to new daring and to success by the profits of audacity, the guiltless not only robbed of their peace of mind, but even of all means of defense. Wherefore I would fain cry out. Song 5. Boethius Prayer. Builder of yon starry dome, thou that whirlest, throned eternal, heaven's swift globe, and, as they roam, guidest the stars by law supernal, so in full sphered splendor dight Cynthia dims the lamps of night, but unto the orb fraternal closer drawn, doth lose her light. Who at fall of eventide, Hesper, his cold radiance showeth, Lucifer his beams doth hide, paling as the sun's light groweth, brief, while winter's frost holds sway, by thy will the space of day, swift, when summer's fervor gloweth, speed the hours of night away. Thou dost rule the changing year, when rude Boreas oppresses, fall the leaves, they reappear, wooed by Zephyr's soft caresses. Fields that Sirius burns deep grown by Arcturus' watch were sown, each the reign of law confesses, keeps the place that is his own. Sovereign ruler, lord of all. Can it be that thou disdainest only man? Gainst him, poor thrall, wanton fortune plays her vainest. Guilt's deserved punishment falleth on the innocent, high uplifted, the profanest on the just their malice vent. Virtue cowers in dark retreats, crimes foul stain the righteous beareth, perjury and false deceits hurt not him the wrong who dareth, but weaner the wicked trust in ill strength to work their lust, kings, whom nations awe declareth mighty, grovel in the dust. Look, O look upon this earth, thou who on law's sure foundation framed'st all. Have we no worth, we poor men, of all creation? Soar we toss on fortune's tide, master, bid the waves subside. And earth's ways with consummation of thy heaven's order guide? 5. When I had poured out my griefs in this long and unbroken strain of lamentation, she, with calm countenance, and in no wise disturbed at my complainings, thus spake. When I saw thee sorrowful, in tears, I straightway knew thee wretched and an exile. But how far distant that exile I should not know, had not thine own speech revealed it. Yet how far indeed from thy country hast thou, not been banished, but rather hast strayed, or, if thou wilt have it banishment, hast banished thyself. For no one else could ever lawfully have had this power over thee. Now, if thou wilt call to mind from what country thou art sprung, it is not ruled, as once was the Athenian polity, by the sovereignty of the multitude, but one is its ruler, one its king, who takes delight in the number of his citizens, not in their banishment, to submit to whose governance and to obey whose ordinances is perfect freedom. Art thou ignorant of that most ancient law of this thy country, whereby it is decreed that no one whatsoever, who hath chosen to fix there his dwelling, may be sent into exile? For truly there is no fear that one who is encompassed by its ramparts and defences should deserve to be exiled. But he who has ceased to wish to dwell therein, he likewise ceases to deserve to do so. And so it is not so much the aspect of this place which moves me, as thy aspect, not so much the library walls set off with glass and ivory which I miss, as the chamber of thy mind, wherein I once placed, not books, but that which gives books their value, the doctrines which my books contain. Now, what thou hast said of thy services to the commonweal is true, only too little compared with the greatness of thy deservings. The things laid to thy charge whereof thou hast spoken, whether such as redound to thy credit, or mere false accusations, are publicly known. As for the crimes and deceits of the informers, thou hast rightly deemed it fitting to pass them over lightly, because the popular voice hath better and more fully pronounced upon them. Thou hast bitterly complained of the injustice of the Senate. Thou hast grieved over my calumniation, and likewise hast lamented the damage to my good name. Finally, thine indignation blazed forth against fortune, thou hast complained of the unfairness with which thy merits have been recompensed. Last of all, thy frantic muse framed a prayer that the peace which reigns in heaven might rule earth also. But since a throng of tumultuous passions hath assailed thy soul, since thou art distraught with anger, pain, and grief, strong remedies are not proper for thee in this thy present mood. And so for a time I will use milder methods, that the tumors which have grown hard through the influx of disturbing passion may be softened by gentle treatment, till they can bear the force of sharper remedies. Song 6. All things have their needful order. He who to th unwilling furrows gives the generous grain, when the crab with baleful fervors scorches all the plain, he shall find his garner bare, acorns for his scanty fare. Go not forth to cull sweet violets from the purpled steep, while the furious blasts of winter through the valleys sweep, nor the grape o'er hasty bring to the press in days of spring. For to each thing God hath given its appointed time, no perplexing change permits he in his plan sublime. So who quits the order due shall a luckless issue rue. 6. First, then, wilt thou suffer me by a few questions to make some attempt to test the state of thy mind, that I may learn in what way to set about thy cure? Ask what thou wilt, said I, for I will answer whatever questions thou choosest to put. Then said she, this world of ours thinkest thou it is governed haphazard and fortuitously, or believest thou that there is in it any rational guidance? Nay, said I, in no wise may I deem that such fixed motions can be determined by random hazard, but I know that God, the Creator, presideth over his work, nor will the day ever come that shall drive me from holding fast the truth of this belief. Yes, said she, thou didst even but now affirm it in song, lamenting that men alone had no portion in the divine care. As to the rest, thou wert unshaken in the belief that they were ruled by reason. Yet I marvel exceedingly how, in spite of thy firm hold on this opinion, thou art fallen into sickness. But let us probe more deeply, something or other is missing, I think. Now, tell me, since thou doubtest not that God governs the world, dost thou perceive by what means he rules it? I scarcely understand what thou meanest, I said, much less can I answer thy question. Did I not say truly that something is missing, whereby, as through a breach in the ramparts, disease hath crept in to disturb thy mind? But, tell me, dost thou remember the universal end towards which the aim of all nature is directed? I once heard, said I, but sorrow hath dulled my recollection. And yet thou knowest whence all things have proceeded. Yes, that I know, said I, and have answered that it is from God. Yet how is it possible that thou knowest not what is the end of existence, when thou dost understand its source and origin? However, these disturbances of mind have force to shake a man's position, but cannot pluck him up and root him altogether out of himself. But answer this also, I pray thee, rememberest thou that thou art a man? How should I not, said I. Then, canst thou say what man is? Is this thy question, whether I know myself for a being endowed with reason and subject to death? Surely I do acknowledge myself such. Then she, dost know nothing else that thou art? Nothing. Now, said she, I know another cause of thy disease, one, two, of grave moment. Thou hast ceased to know thy own nature. So, then, I have made full discovery both of the causes of thy sickness and the means of restoring thy health. It is because forgetfulness of thyself hath bewildered thy mind that thou hast bewailed thee as an exile, as one stripped of the blessings that were his. It is because thou knowest not the end of existence that thou deemest abominable and wicked men to be happy and powerful, while, because thou hast forgotten by what means the earth is governed, thou deemest that fortune's changes ebb and flow without the restraint of a guiding hand. These are serious enough to cause not sickness only, but even death, but, thanks be to the author of our health, the light of nature hath not yet left thee utterly. In thy true judgment concerning the world's government, in that thou believest it subject, not to the random drift of chance, but to divine reason, we have the divine spark from which thy recovery may be hoped. Have, then, no fear, from these weak embers the vital heat shall once more be kindled within thee. But seeing that it is not yet time for strong remedies, and that the mind is manifestly so constituted that when it casts off true opinions it straightway puts on false, wherefrom arises a cloud of confusion that disturbs its true vision, I will now try and disperse these mists by mild and soothing application, that so the darkness of misleading passion may be scattered, and thou mayst come to discern the splendor of the true light. Song 7. The Perturbations of Passion. Stars shed no light through the black night, when the clouds hide, and the lashed wave, if the winds rave o'er ocean's tide. Though once serene as day's fair sheen soon fouled and spoiled by the storm's spite, shows to the sight turbid and soiled. Oft the fair rill, down the steep hill seaward that strays, some tumbled block of fallen rock hinders and stays. Then art thou fain clear and most plain truth to discern, in the right way firmly to stay, nor from it turn? Joy, hope and fear suffer not near, drive grief away, shackled and blind and lost is the mind where these have sway. Book 2. The Vanity of Fortune's Gifts. Book 2. 1. Thereafter for a while she remained silent, and when she had restored my flagging attention by a moderate pause in her discourse, she thus began, If I have thoroughly ascertained the character and causes of thy sickness, thou art pining with regretful longing for thy former fortune. It is the change, as thou deemest, of this fortune that hath so wrought upon thy mind. Well do I understand that Siren's manifold wiles, the fatal charm of the friendship she pretends for her victims, so long as she is scheming to entrap them, how she unexpectedly abandons them and leaves them overwhelmed with insupportable grief. Bethink thee of her nature, character, and deserts, and thou wilt soon acknowledge that in her thou hast neither possessed, nor hast thou lost, aught of any worth. Methinks I need not spend much pains in bringing this to thy mind, since, even when she was still with thee, even while she was caressing thee, thou usedst to assail her in manly terms, to rebuke her, with maxims drawn from my holy treasure house. But all sudden changes of circumstances bring inevitably a certain commotion of spirit. Thus it hath come to pass that thou also for a while hast been parted from thy mind's tranquility. But it is time for thee to take and drain a draught, soft and pleasant to the taste, which, as it penetrates within, may prepare the way for stronger potions. Wherefore I call to my aid the sweet persuasiveness of rhetoric, who then only walketh in the right way when she forsakes not my instructions, and music, my handmaid, I bid to join with her singing, now in lighter, now in graver strain. What is it, then, poor mortal, that hath cast thee into lamentation and mourning? Some strange, unwonted sight, methinks, have thine eyes seen. Thou deemest fortune to have changed towards thee, thou mistakest. Such ever were her ways, ever such her nature. Rather in her very mutability hath she preserved towards thee her true constancy. Such was she when she loaded thee with caresses, when she deluded thee with the allurements of a false happiness. Thou hast found out how changeful is the face of the blind goddess. She who still veils herself from others hath fully discovered to thee her whole character. If thou likest her, take her as she is, and do not complain. If thou abhorrest her perfidy, turn from her in disdain, renounce her, for baneful are her delusions. The very thing which is now the cause of thy great grief ought to have brought thee tranquility. Thou hast been forsaken by one of whom no one can be sure that she will not forsake him. Or dost thou indeed set value on a happiness that is certain to depart? Again I ask, is fortune's presence dear to thee if she cannot be trusted to stay, and though she will bring sorrow when she is gone? Why, if she cannot be kept at pleasure, and if her flight overwhelms with calamity, what is this fleeting visitant but a token of coming trouble? Truly it is not enough to look only at what lies before the eyes, wisdom gauges the issues of things, and this same mutability, with its two aspects, makes the threats of fortune void of terror, and her caresses little to be desired. Finally, thou oughtest to bear with whatever takes place within the boundaries of fortune's domain, when thou hast placed thy head beneath her yoke. But if thou wishest to impose a law of staying and departing on her whom thou hast of thine own accord chosen for thy mistress, art thou not acting wrongfully, art thou not embittering by impatience a lot which thou canst not alter? Didst thou commit thy sails to the winds, thou wouldst voyage not whither thy intention was to go, but whither the winds drave thee, didst thou entrust thy seed to the fields, thou wouldst set off the fruitful years against the barren. Thou hast resigned thyself to the sway of fortune, thou must submit to thy mistress's caprices. What? Art thou verily striving to stay the swing of the revolving wheel? Oh, stupidest of mortals, if it takes to standing still, it ceases to be the will of fortune. Song 1. Fortune's malice. Mad fortune sweeps along in wanton pride, uncertain as Europe's surging tide, now tramples mighty kings beneath her feet, now sets the conquered in the victor's seat. She heedeth not the wail of hapless woe, but mocks the griefs that from her mischief flow. Such is her sport, so proveth she her power, and great the marvel, when in one brief hour she shows her darling lifted high in bliss, then headlong plunged in misery's abyss. 2. Now I would fain also reason with thee a little in fortune's own words. Do thou observe whether her contentions be just? Man, she might say, why dost thou pursue me with thy daily complainings? What wrong have I done thee? What goods of thine have I taken from thee? Choose and thou wilt adjudge, and let us dispute before him concerning the rightful ownership of wealth and rank. If thou succeedest in showing that any one of these things is the true property of mortal man, I freely grant those things to be thine which thou claimest. When nature brought thee forth out of thy mother's womb, I took thee, naked and destitute as thou wast, I cherished thee with my substance, and, in the partiality of my favor for thee, I brought thee up somewhat too indulgently, and this it is which now makes thee rebellious against me. I surrounded thee with a royal abundance of all those things that are in my power. Now it is my pleasure to draw back my hand. Thou hast reason to thank me for the use of what was not thine own, thou hast no right to complain, as if thou hadst lost what was wholly thine. Why, then, dost bemoan thyself? I have done thee no violence. Wealth, honor, and all such things are placed under my control. My handmaidens know their mistress, with me they come, and at my going they depart. I might boldly affirm that if those things the loss of which thou lamentest had been thine, thou couldst never have lost them. Am I alone to be forbidden to do what I will with my own? Unrebuked, the skies now reveal the brightness of day, now shroud the daylight in the darkness of night, the year may now engarland the face of the earth with flowers and fruits, now disfigure it with storms and cold. The sea is permitted to invite with smooth and tranquil surface today, tomorrow to roughen with wave and storm. Shall man's insatiate greed bind me to a constancy foreign to my character? This is my art, this the game I never cease to play. I turn the wheel that spins. I delight to see the high come down and the low ascend. Mount up, if thou wilt, but only on condition that thou wilt not think it a hardship to come down when the rules of my game require it. Wert thou ignorant of my character? Didst not know how Croesus, king of the Lydians, erstwhile the dreaded rival of Cyrus, was afterwards pitiably consigned to the flame of the pyre, and only saved by a shower sent from heaven? Has it escaped thee how Paulus paid a meed of pious tears to the misfortunes of King Perseus, his prisoner? What else do tragedies make such woeful outcry over save the overthrow of kingdoms by the indiscriminate strokes of fortune? Didst thou not learn in thy childhood how there stand at the threshold of Zeus two jars, the one full of blessings, the other of calamities? How if thou hast drawn over liberally from the good jar? What if not even now have I departed wholly from thee? What if this very mutability of mine is a just ground for hoping better things? But listen now, and cease to let thy heart consume away with fretfulness, nor expect to live on thine own terms in a realm that is common to all. Song 2. Man's Covetousness. What though plenty pour her gifts with a lavish hand, numberless as are the stars, countless as the sand, will the race of man, content, cease to murmur and lament? Nay, though God, all bounteous, give gold at man's desire honors, rank, and fame, content not a whit is nigher, but an all-devouring greed yawns with ever-widening need. Then what bounds can e'er restrain this wild lust of having, when with each new bounty fed grows the frantic craving? He is never rich whose fear sees grim want forever near. 3. If fortune should plead thus against thee, assuredly thou wouldst not have one word to offer in reply, or, if thou canst find any justification of thy complainings, thou must show what it is. I will give thee space to speak. Then said I, verily, thy pleas are plausible, yea, steeped in the honeyed sweetness of music and rhetoric. But their charm lasts only while they are sounding in the ear, the sense of his misfortunes lies deeper in the heart of the wretched. So, when the sound ceases to vibrate upon the air, the heart's indwelling sorrow is felt with renewed bitterness. Then said she, it is indeed as thou sayest, for we have not yet come to the curing of thy sickness, as yet these are but lenitives conducing to the treatment of a malady hitherto obstinate. The remedies which go deep I will apply in due season. Nevertheless, to deprecate thy determination to be thought wretched, I ask thee, hast thou forgotten the extent and bounds of thy felicity? I say nothing of how, when orphaned and desolate, thou wast taken into the care of illustrious men, how thou wast chosen for alliance with the highest in the state, and even before thou wert bound to their house by marriage, wert already dear to their love, which is the most precious of all ties. Did not all pronounce thee most happy in the virtues of thy wife, the splendid honors of her father, and the blessing of male issue? I pass over, for I care not to speak of blessings in which others also have shared, the distinctions often denied to age which thou enjoyedst in thy youth. I choose rather to come to the unparalleled culmination of thy good fortune. If the fruition of any earthly success has weight in the scale of happiness, can the memory of that splendor be swept away by any rising flood of troubles? That day when thou didst see thy two sons ride forth from home joint consuls, followed by a train of senators, and welcomed by the goodwill of the people, when these two sat in curule chairs in the Senate House, and thou by thy panegyric on the king didst earn the fame of eloquence and ability, when in the circus, seated between the two consuls, thou didst glut the multitude thronging around with the triumphal largesses for which they looked, methinks thou didst cozen fortune while she caressed thee, and made thee her darling. Thou didst bear off a boon which she had never before granted to any private person. Art thou, then, minded to cast up a reckoning with fortune? Now for the first time she has turned a jealous glance upon thee. If thou compare the extent and bounds of thy blessings and misfortunes, thou canst not deny that thou art still fortunate. Or if thou esteem not thyself favored by fortune in that thy then seeming prosperity hath departed, deem not thyself wretched, since what thou now believest to be calamitous passeth also. What? Art thou but now come suddenly and a stranger to the scene of this life? Thinkest thou there is any stability in human affairs, when man himself vanishes away in the swift course of time? It is true that there is little trust that the gifts of chance will abide, yet the last day of life is in a manner the death of all remaining fortune. What difference, then, thinkest thou, is there, whether thou leavest her by dying, or she leave thee by fleeing away? Song 3. All passes. When, in rosy chariot drawn, Phoebus gins to light the dawn, by his flaming beams assailed, every glimmering star is paled. When the grove, by zephyrs fed, with rose blossom blushes red, doth rude Auster breathe thereon, bare it stands, its glory gone. Smooth and tranquil lies the deep while the winds are hushed in sleep. Soon, when angry tempests lash, wild and high the billows dash. Thus if nature's changing face holds not still a moment's space, fleeting deem man's fortunes, deem bliss as transient as a dream. One law only standeth fast, things created may not last. 4. Then said I, true are thine admonishings, thou nurse of all excellence, nor can I deny the wonder of my fortune's swift career. Yet it is this which chafes me the more cruelly in the recalling. For truly in adverse fortune the worst sting of misery is to have been happy. Well, said she, if thou art paying the penalty of a mistaken belief, thou canst not rightly impute the fault to circumstances. If it is the felicity which fortune gives that moves thee mere name though it be come reckon up with me how rich thou art in the number and weightiness of thy blessings. Then if, by the blessing of providence, thou hast still preserved unto thee safe and inviolate that which, howsoever thou mightest reckon thy fortune, thou wouldst have thought thy most precious possession, what right hast thou to talk of ill fortune whilst keeping all fortune's better gifts? Yet Symmachus, thy wife's father a man whose splendid character does honor to the human race is safe and unharmed, and while he bewails thy wrongs, this rare nature, in whom wisdom and virtue are so nobly blended, is himself out of danger a boon thou wouldst have been quick to purchase at the price of life itself. Thy wife yet lives, with her gentle disposition, her peerless modesty and virtue this the epitome of all her graces, that she is the true daughter of her sire she lives, I say, and for thy sake only preserves the breath of life, though she loathes it, and pines away in grief and tears for thy absence, wherein, if in naught else, I would allow some marring of thy felicity. What shall I say of thy sons and their consular dignity how in them, so far as may be in youths of their age, the example of their fathers and grandfathers' character shines out? Since, then, the chief care of mortal man is to preserve his life, how happy art thou, couldst thou but recognize thy blessings, who possessest even now what no one doubts to be dearer than life. Wherefore, now dry thy tears. Fortune's hate hath not involved all thy dear ones, the stress of the storm that has assailed thee is not beyond measure intolerable, since there are anchors still holding firm which suffer thee not to lack either consolation in the present or hope for the future. I pray that they still may hold. For while they still remain, however things may go, I shall ride out the storm. Yet thou seest how much is shorn of the splendor of my fortunes. We are gaining a little ground, said she, if there is something in thy lot wherewith thou art not yet altogether discontented. But I cannot stomach thy daintiness when thou complainest with such violence of grief and anxiety because thy happiness falls short of completeness. Why, who enjoys such settled felicity as not to have some quarrel with the circumstances of his lot? A troublous matter are the conditions of human bliss, either they are never realized in full, or never stay permanently. One has abundant riches, but is shamed by his ignoble birth. Another is conspicuous for his nobility, but through the embarrassments of poverty would prefer to be obscure. A third, richly endowed with both, laments the loneliness of an unwed life. Another, though happily married, is doomed to childlessness, and nurses his wealth for a stranger to inherit. Yet another, blessed with children, mournfully bewails the misdeeds of son or daughter. Wherefore, it is not easy for anyone to be at perfect peace with the circumstances of his lot. There lurks in each several portion something which they who experience it not know nothing of, but which makes the sufferer wince. Besides, the more favored a man is by fortune, the more fastidiously sensitive is he, and, unless all things answer to his whim, he is overwhelmed by the most trifling misfortunes, because utterly unschooled in adversity. So petty are the trifles which rob the most fortunate of perfect happiness. How many are there, dost thou imagine, who would think themselves nigh heaven, if but a small portion from the wreck of thy fortune should fall to them? This very place which thou callest exile is to them that dwell therein their native land. So true is it that nothing is wretched, but thinking makes it so, and conversely every lot is happy if borne with equanimity. Who is so blessed by fortune as not to wish to change his state, if once he gives rein to a rebellious spirit? With how many bitternesses is the sweetness of human felicity blent? And even if that sweetness seemed to him to bring delight in the enjoying, yet he cannot keep it from departing when it will. How manifestly wretched, then, is the bliss of earthly fortune, which lasts not forever with those whose temper is equable, and can give no perfect satisfaction to the anxious-minded. Why, then, ye children of mortality, seek ye from without that happiness whose seat is only within us? Error and ignorance bewilder you. I will show thee, in brief, the hinge on which perfect happiness turns. Is there anything more precious to thee than thyself? Nothing, thou wilt say. If, then, thou art master of thyself, thou wilt possess that which thou wilt never be willing to lose, and which fortune cannot take from thee. And that thou mayst see that happiness cannot possibly consist in these things which are the sport of chance, reflect that, if happiness is the highest good of a creature living in accordance with reason, and if a thing which can in any wise be reft away is not the highest good, since that which cannot be taken away is better than it, it is plain that fortune cannot aspire to bestow happiness by reason of its instability. And, besides, a man borne along by this transitory felicity must either know or not know its instability. If he knows not, how poor is a happiness which depends on the blindness of ignorance? If he knows it, he needs must fear to lose a happiness whose loss he believes to be possible. Wherefore, a never-ceasing fear suffers him not to be happy. Or does he count the possibility of this loss a trifling matter? Insignificant, then, must be the good whose loss can be borne so equably. And, further, I know thee to be one settled in the belief that the souls of men certainly die not with them, and convinced thereof by numerous proofs, it is clear also that the felicity which fortune bestows is brought to an end with the death of the body, therefore, it cannot be doubted but that, if happiness is conferred in this way, the whole human race sinks into misery when death brings the close of all. But if we know that many have sought the joy of happiness not through death only, but also through pain and suffering, how can life make men happy by its presence when it makes them not wretched by its loss? Song 4. The Golden Mean. Who founded firm and sure would ever live secure, in spite of storm and blast immovable and fast, whoso would fain deride the ocean's threatening tide, his dwelling should not seek on sands or mountain peak. Upon the mountain's height the storm winds wreak their spite, the shifting sands disdain their burden to sustain. Do thou these perils flee, fair though the prospect be, and fix thy resting place on some low rock's sure base. Then, though the tempests roar, seas thunder on the shore, thou in thy stronghold blessed and undisturbed shalt rest, live all thy days serene, and mock the heaven's spleen. 5. But since my reasonings begin to work a soothing effect within thy mind, methinks I may resort to remedies somewhat stronger. Come, suppose, now, the gifts of fortune were not fleeting and transitory, what is there in them capable of ever becoming truly thine, or which does not lose value when looked at steadily and fairly weighed in the balance? Are riches, I pray thee, precious either through thy nature or in their own? What are they but mere gold and heaps of money? Yet these fine things show their quality better in the spending than in the hoarding, for I suppose 'tis plain that greed always makes men hateful, while liberality brings fame. But that which is transferred to another cannot remain in one's own possession, and if that be so, then money is only precious when it is given away, and, by being transferred to others, ceases to be one's own. Again, if all the money in the world were heaped up in one man's possession, all others would be made poor. Sound fills the ears of many at the same time without being broken into parts, but your riches cannot pass to many without being lessened in the process. And when this happens, they must needs impoverish those whom they leave. How poor and cramped a thing, then, is riches, which more than one cannot possess as an unbroken whole, which falls not to any one man's lot without the impoverishment of everyone else. Or is it the glitter of gems that allures the eye? Yet, how rarely excellent soever may be their splendor, remember the flashing light is in the jewels, not in the man. Indeed, I greatly marvel at men's admiration of them, for what can rightly seem beautiful to a being endowed with life and reason, if it lacked the movement and structure of life. And although such things do in the end take on them more beauty from their maker's care and their own brilliancy, still they in no wise merit your admiration, since their excellence is set at a lower grade than your own. Does the beauty of the fields delight you? Surely, yes, it is a beautiful part of a right beautiful whole. Fitly indeed do we at times enjoy the serene calm of the sea, admire the sky, the stars, the moon, the sun. Yet is any of these thy concern? Dost thou venture to boast thyself of the beauty of any one of them? Art thou decked with spring's flowers? Is it thy fertility that swelleth in the fruits of autumn? Why art thou moved with empty transports? Why embracest thou an alien excellence as thine own? Never will fortune make thine that which the nature of things has excluded from thy ownership. Doubtless the fruits of the earth are given for the sustenance of living creatures. But if thou art content to supply thy wants so far as suffices nature, there is no need to resort to fortune's bounty. Nature is content with few things, and with a very little of these. If thou art minded to force superfluities upon her when she is satisfied, that which thou addest will prove either unpleasant or harmful. But, now, thou thinkest it fine to shine in raiment of divers colors, yet if, indeed, there is any pleasure in the sight of such things, it is the texture or the artist's skill which I shall admire. Or perhaps it is a long train of servants that makes thee happy. Why, if they behave viciously, they are a ruinous burden to thy house, and exceeding dangerous to their own master, while if they are honest, how canst thou count other men's virtue in the sum of thy possessions? From all which 'tis plainly proved that not one of these things which thou reckonest in the number of thy possessions is really thine. And if there is in them no beauty to be desired, why shouldst thou either grieve for their loss or find joy in their continued possession? While if they are beautiful in their own nature, what is that to thee? They would have been not less pleasing in themselves, though never included among thy possessions. For they derive not their preciousness from being counted in thy riches, but rather thou hast chosen to count them in thy riches because they seem to thee precious. Then, what seek ye by all this noisy outcry about fortune? To chase away poverty, I ween, by means of abundance. And yet ye find the result just contrary. Why, this varied array of precious furniture needs more accessories for its protection. It is a true saying that they want most who possess most, and, conversely, they want very little who measure their abundance by nature's requirements, not by the superfluity of vain display. Have ye no good of your own implanted within you, that ye seek your good in things external and separate? Is the nature of things so reversed that a creature divine by right of reason can in no other way be splendid in his own eyes save by the possession of lifeless chattels? Yet, while other things are content with their own, ye who in your intellect are godlike seek from the lowest of things adornment for a nature of supreme excellence, and perceive not how great a wrong ye do your Maker. His will was that mankind should excel all things on earth. Ye thrust down your worth beneath the lowest of things. For if that in which each thing finds its good is plainly more precious than that whose good it is, by your own estimation ye put yourselves below the vilest of things, when ye deem these vile things to be your good, nor does this fall out undeservedly. Indeed, man is so constituted that he then only excels other things when he knows himself, but he is brought lower than the beasts if he lose the self-knowledge. For that other creatures should be ignorant of themselves is natural, in man it shows as a defect. How extravagant, then, is this error of yours, in thinking that anything can be embellished by adornments not its own? It cannot be. For if such accessories add any luster, it is the accessories that get the praise, while that which they veil and cover remains in its pristine ugliness. And again I say, that is no good, which injures its possessor. Is this untrue? No, quite true, thou sayest. And yet riches have often hurt those that possess them, since the worst of men, who are all the more covetous by reason of their wickedness, think none but themselves worthy to possess all the gold and gems the world contains. So thou, who now dreadest pike and sword, mightest have trolled a carol in the robber's face, hadst thou entered the road of life with empty pockets. Oh, wondrous blessedness of perishable wealth, whose acquisition robs thee of security. Song 5. The former age. Too blessed the former age, their life who in the fields contented led, and still, by luxury unspoiled, on frugal acorns sparely fed. No skill was theirs the luscious grape with honey's sweetness to confuse, nor China's soft and sheeny silks tea and purple with brave Tyrian hues. The grass their wholesome couch, their drink the stream, their roof the pine's tall shade, not theirs to cleave the deep, nor seek in strange far lands the spoils of trade. The trump of war was heard not yet, nor soiled the fields by bloodshed stain, for why should war's fierce madness arm when strife brought wound, but brought not gain? Ah! Would our hearts might still return to following in those ancient ways. Alas! The greed of getting glows more fierce than Aetna's fiery blaze. Woe, woe for him, whoe'er it was, who first gold's hidden store revealed, and perilous treasure trove dug out the gems that fain would be concealed. 6. What now shall I say of rank and power, whereby, because ye know not true power and dignity, ye hope to reach the sky? Yet, when rank and power have fallen to the worst of men, did ever an Aetna, belching forth flame and fiery deluge, work such mischief? Verily, as I think, thou dost remember how thine ancestors sought to abolish the consular power, which had been the foundation of their liberties, on account of the overweening pride of the consuls, and how for that self-same pride they had already abolished the kingly title. And if, as happens but rarely, these prerogatives are conferred on virtuous men, it is only the virtue of those who exercise them that pleases. So it appears that honor cometh not to virtue from rank, but to rank from virtue. Look, too, at the nature of that power which ye find so attractive and glorious. Do ye never consider, ye creatures of earth, what ye are, and over whom ye exercise your fancied lordship? Suppose, now, that in the mouse tribe there should rise up one claiming rights and powers for himself above the rest, would ye not laugh consumedly? Yet if thou lookest to his body alone, what creature canst thou find more feeble than man, who oftentimes is killed by the bite of a fly, or by some insect creeping into the inner passage of his system? Yet what rights can one exercise over another, save only as regards the body, and that which is lower than the body, I mean fortune? What? Wilt thou bind with thy mandates the free spirit? Canst thou force from its due tranquility the mind that is firmly composed by reason? A tyrant thought to drive a man of free birth to reveal his accomplices in a conspiracy, but the prisoner bit off his tongue and threw it into the furious tyrant's face. Thus, the tortures which the tyrant thought the instrument of his cruelty, the sage made an opportunity for heroism. Moreover, what is there that one man can do to another which he himself may not have to undergo in his turn? We are told that Byzarus, who used to kill his guests, was himself slain by his guest, Hercules. Regulus had thrown into bonds many of the Carthaginians whom he had taken in war, soon after he himself submitted his hands to the chains of the vanquished. Then, thinkest thou that man hath any power who cannot prevent another's being able to do to him what he himself can do to others? Besides, if there were any element of natural and proper good in rank and power, they would never come to the utterly bad, since opposites are not wont to be associated. Nature brooks not the union of contraries. So, seeing there is no doubt that wicked wretches are oftentimes set in high places, it is also clear that things which suffer association with the worst of men cannot be good in their own nature. Indeed, this judgment may with some reason be passed concerning all the gifts of fortune which fall so plentifully to all the most wicked. This ought also to be considered here, I think. No one doubts a man to be brave in whom he has observed a brave spirit residing. It is plain that one who is endowed with speed is swift-footed. So also music makes men musical, the healing art physicians, rhetoric public speakers. For each of these has naturally its own proper working, there is no confusion with the effects of contrary things, nay, even of itself it rejects what is incompatible. And yet wealth cannot extinguish insatiable greed, nor has power ever made him master of himself whom vicious lusts kept bound in indissoluble fetters. Dignity conferred on the wicked not only fails to make them worthy, but contrarily reveals and displays their unworthiness. Why does it so happen? Because ye take pleasure in calling by false names things whose nature is quite incongruous thereto by names which are easily proved false by the very effects of the things themselves. Even so it is, these riches, that power, this dignity, are none of them rightly so called. Finally, we may draw the same conclusion concerning the whole sphere of fortune, within which there is plainly nothing to be truly desired, nothing of intrinsic excellence, for she neither always joins herself to the good, nor does she make good men of those to whom she is united. Song 6. Nero's infamy. We know what mischief dire he wrought. Rome fired, the fathers slain whose hand with brother's slaughter wet a mother's blood did stain. No pitying tear his cheek bedewed, as on the corse he gazed, that mother's beauty, once so fair, a critic's voice appraised. Yet far and wide, from east to west, his sway the nations own, and scorching south and icy north obey his will alone. Did, then, high power a curb impose on Nero's frenzied will? Ah, woe when to the evil heart is joined the sword to kill. 7. Then said I, thou knowest thyself that ambition for worldly success hath but little swayed me. Yet I have desired opportunity for action, lest virtue, in default of exercise, should languish away. Then she, this is that last infirmity which is able to allure minds which, though of noble quality, have not yet been molded to any exquisite refinement by the perfecting of the virtues, I mean, the love of glory and fame for high services rendered to the commonweal. And yet consider with me how poor and unsubstantial a thing this glory is. The whole of this earth's globe, as thou hast learned from the demonstration of astronomy, compared with the expanse of heaven, is found no bigger than a point, that is to say, if measured by the vastness of heaven's sphere, it is held to occupy absolutely no space at all. Now, of this so insignificant portion of the universe, it is about a fourth part, as Ptolemy's proofs have taught us, which is inhabited by living creatures known to us. If from this fourth part you take away in thought all that is usurped by seas and marshes, or lies a vast waste of waterless desert, barely is an exceeding narrow area left for human habitation. You, then, who are shut in and prisoned in this merest fraction of a point's space, do ye take thought for the blazoning of your fame, for the spreading abroad of your renown? Why, what amplitude or magnificence has glory when confined to such narrow and petty limits? Besides, the straitened bounds of this scant dwelling place are inhabited by many nations differing widely in speech, in usages, in mode of life. To many of these, from the difficulty of travel, from diversities of speech, from want of commercial intercourse, the fame not only of individual men, but even of cities, is unable to reach. Why, in Cicero's days, as he himself somewhere points out, the fame of the Roman Republic had not yet crossed the Caucasus, and yet by that time her name had grown formidable to the Parthians and other nations of those parts. Seest thou, then, how narrow, how confined, is the glory ye take pains to spread abroad and extend? Can the fame of a single Roman penetrate where the glory of the Roman name fails to pass? Moreover, the customs and institutions of different races agree not together, so that what is deemed praiseworthy in one country is thought punishable in another. Wherefore, if any love the applause of fame, it shall not profit him to publish his name among many peoples. Then, each must be content to have the range of his glory limited to his own people, the splendid immortality of fame must be confined within the bounds of a single race. Once more, how many of high renown in their own times have been lost in oblivion for want of a record? Indeed, of what avail are written records even, which, with their authors, are overtaken by the dimness of age after a somewhat longer time? But ye, when ye think on future fame, fancy it an immortality that ye are begetting for yourselves. Why, if thou scannest the infinite spaces of eternity, what room hast thou left for rejoicing in the durability of thy name? Verily, if a single moment's space be compared with 10,000 years, it has a certain relative duration, however little, since each period is definite. But this same number of years I, and a number many times as great cannot even be compared with endless duration, for, Indeed, finite periods may in a sort be compared one with another, but a finite and an infinite never. So it comes to pass that fame, though it extend to ever so wide a space of years, if it be compared to never lessening eternity, seems not short-lived merely, but altogether nothing. But as for you, ye know not how to act aright, unless it be to court the popular breeze, and win the empty applause of the multitude, nay, ye abandon the superlative worth of conscience and virtue, and ask a recompense from the poor words of others. Let me tell thee how wittily one did mock the shallowness of this sort of arrogance. A certain man assailed one who had put on the name of philosopher as a cloak to pride and vainglory, not for the practice of real virtue, and added, "Now shall I know if thou art a philosopher if thou bearest reproaches calmly and patiently." The other for a while affected to be patient, and, having endured to be abused, cried out derisively, "Now, do you see that I am a philosopher?" The other, with biting sarcasm, retorted, "I should have hadst thou held thy peace. Moreover, what concern have choice spirits, for it is of such men we speak, men who seek glory by virtue, what concern, I say, have these with fame after the dissolution of the body in death's last hour? For if men die wholly, which our reasonings forbid us to believe, there is no such thing as glory at all, since he to whom the glory is said to belong is altogether non-existent. But if the mind, conscious of its own rectitude, is released from its earthly prison, and seeks heaven in free flight, doth it not despise all earthly things when it rejoices in its deliverance from earthly bonds, and enters upon the joys of heaven?" Song 7. Glory may not last. Oh, let him, who pants for glory's guerdon, deeming glory all in all, look and see how wide the heaven expandeth, earth's enclosing bounds how small. Shame it is, if your proud swelling glory may not fill this narrow room. Why, then, strive so vainly, oh, ye proud ones, to escape your mortal doom? Though your name, to distant regions bruited, o'er the earth be widely spread, though full many a lofty sounding title on your house its luster shed. Death at all this pomp and glory spurneth when his hour draweth nigh, shrouds alike th exalted and the humble, levels lowest and most high. Where are now the bones of stanch Fabricius? Brutus, Cato, where are they? Lingering fame, with a few graven letters, doth their empty name display. But to know the great dead is not given from a gilded name alone, nay, yet all alike must lie forgotten, 'tis not you that fame makes known. Fondly do ye deem life's little hour lengthened by fame's mortal breath, there but waits you when this, too, is taken at the last a second death. 8. But that thou mayst not think that I wage implacable warfare against fortune, I own there is a time when the deceitful goddess serves men well, I mean when she reveals herself, uncovers her face, and confesses her true character. Perhaps thou dost not yet grasp my meaning. Strange is the thing I am trying to express, and for this cause I can scarce find words to make clear my thought. For truly I believe that ill fortune is of more use to men than good fortune. For good fortune, when she wears the guise of happiness, and most seems to caress, is always lying; ill fortune is always truthful, since, in changing, she shows her inconstancy. The one deceives, the other teaches; the one enchains the minds of those who enjoy her favor by the semblance of delusive good, the other delivers them by the knowledge of the frail nature of happiness. Accordingly, thou mayst see the one fickle, shifting as the breeze, and ever self-deceived, the other sober-minded, alert, and wary, by reason of the very discipline of adversity. Finally, good fortune, by her allurements, draws men far from the true good; ill fortune oft-times draws men back to true good with grappling irons. Again, should it be esteemed a trifling boon, thinkest thou, that this cruel, this odious fortune hath discovered to thee the hearts of thy faithful friends that other hid from thee alike the faces of the true friends and of the false, but in departing she hath taken away her friends, and left thee thine? What price wouldst thou not have given for this service in the fullness of thy prosperity when thou seemedst to thyself fortunate? Cease, then, to seek the wealth thou hast lost, since in true friends thou hast found the most precious of all riches. Song 8. Love is Lord of all. Why are nature's changes bound to a fixed and ordered round? What to league peace hath bent every warring element? Wherefore doth the rosy morn rise on Phoebus' car upborne? Why should Phoebe rule the night, led by Hesper's guiding light? What the power that doth restrain in his place the restless main, that within fixed bounds he keeps, nor o'er earth in deluge sweeps? Love it is that holds the chains, love o'er sea and earth that reigns, love whom else but sovereign love, love, high Lord in heaven above. Yet should he his care remit, all that now so close is knit in sweet love and holy peace, would no more from conflict cease, but with strife's rude shock and jar all the world's fair fabric march. Tribes and nations love unites by just treaty's sacred rites, wedlock's bonds he sanctifies by affection's softest ties. Love appointeth, as is due, faithful laws to comrades' true love, all sovereign love. Oh, then, ye are blessed, ye sons of men, if the love that rules the sky in your hearts is throned on high.